Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to my good bad brain. I'm a normal person, so I'm insane. I've got depression and ADHD, but I'm doing better since I medicated me. I'm still not always sure whether I exist or what being a person even really is, but I figured out a long time ago that being alive is beautiful.
Hi, everyone. Hello. Hey, it's my good bad brain. So, as the world continues to be wacky, to say the least, I think a lot of us are wondering what the fuck we're supposed to do or what's going to happen in this moment. Some of us aren't wondering. I mean, I don't know. I think a lot of us are wondering. I mean, what I was going to say is that some of us aren't wondering. Some people have the choice made for them. They have no other choices. We have no other choices. I saw this thing the other day that was like, you know, 8-9 hour lines outside of an unemployment office. I forget which state it said it was. And someone retweeted it saying like, you know, hey, the experience that people who have the ability to work from home take their job and keep doing it just from home and the rest of America is really different right now. And I was thinking about that. I was thinking about how crazy it is that everybody's reopening. Just this incredibly risky time. And that so many people, 40 million Americans, something like that, are filed for unemployment now. That, I mean, who knows? Maybe the government will fill in the gap. Maybe they'll extend benefits. Maybe they'll keep staving it off. But based on the responses of police to things and the response of the conservative wing of the government, the fascist government, I mean, they really are fascism. I mean, you know, people don't like you. I don't know, I think some people maybe don't like that term. Well, I mean, they must like that term because they think Antifa, anti-fascists, are bad guys, but just means ultra-nationalists, you know, ultra-nationalists who, you know, seem to glorify militarism and sort of blindly believe in their version of nation. And there's always some kind of like supremacy tied into it, usually white supremacy, right? Anyway, all this going on, all this craziness, some people, I think a lot of people kind of have this option to try to like lay low and duck out of it. You know what I mean? To like not speak up. I mean, I could. I'm white, you know, I'm male. Cis, straight, it's pretty fucking sitting easy for me. I'm, you know, in an okay situation financially, like just, I'll be okay, you know? So I think a lot of people like that, you know, we could just sit it out or, you know, figure out which way the wind's going to blow, kind of do the both sides-ism thing. I was talking to my brother, he's got some friends, you know, who are really into doing the both sides thing. And it's like, fuck, why? Just because you're afraid of making somebody mad at you? You know? I don't know. I really, I don't know. I don't think any of us are free until we're all free. I don't know. And I don't know how we could live in a world where we're okay just being okay when other people aren't okay. Anyway, so part of the anxiety that went into the conversation in this episode has to do with increasing violence around the country, you know, and not just police violence, obviously, and that sort of institutional violence, but, you know, the increase, there's lynchings happening all over the country that the authorities don't want to call that. And that's scary. And also the fact of the utility of violence seeming evident in the successive protests and the riots, frankly, that the message that the government has given people in need basically is, you know, we did peaceful protesting a long time. People did a lot of voting. They did a lot of, lobbying and requesting and making their voices heard. And the sort of people in power just said, oh, good job, you're making your voice heard, and did nothing. And then told them that peaceful protest is the only way. And then all these people did a little bit of disruption just in the form of protest, some property damage that I think is completely legitimate form of protest. And, what do you know? Things start changing. So what do you tell people? What happens when that happens? You tell them peaceful protesting is like the only way through. And it made me think, and then, you know, clearly the violence that you guys use all the time on people to control people, that's, you know, obviously that's not nonviolent work. That seems to work for you. And all of a sudden you're listening when we do it. So getting to this tricky idea, when you're good people, you're disinclined towards any kind of violence. You're disinclined towards, even in defense, you just don't like hurting people. Nobody likes hurting people. I mean, nobody I know. I don't know. It's the worst. I've on the record talking about how I'm attracted to violence. I like doing violence. I love sparring and fighting and video games and stuff. I don't like hurting people. There's a very intense distinction in my mind. But I guess this phrase always echoes in my head about like the utility of violence and this notion of, so there's some very glib martial artsy thing they say I've heard is violence is never the answer, but when it is the answer, it's the only answer. You know, that there's this kind of like disingenuous thing in the powers that be telling you nonviolence is always the answer. You don't get anything done without, in that like they use it all the time. And it seems like a way to kind of take away a tool of protection and empowerment from you. And this is a crazy sounding rhetoric maybe, but I think part of the reason it's important to think about these things is that not even in terms of physical violence, right? Just emotional, just conflict. People are so averse to it that it's scary to stand up for what you believe in. It's scary to disagree with people. The fear of any kind of disruption that could be described as violent, which even like disagreements emotionally, right? They force people into earn positions of privilege to feel that they should do some with both sidesism. What do you know? And on top of it, violence, which is present every day and systemic, is something that people don't recognize. The violence of private prisons, of standard policing practices, which allow for so much prerogative on the part of the individual officer, that a culture of racism is all you need, even if the policies written are quote unquote fair, you know, which they're not. But so I think that, I guess I wanted to introduce this notion of talking about violence, the utility of violence, I guess, and sort of getting, because I think if you're a good person, I don't think it's crazy to say if you're a good person, you're a nonviolent one. If you're a good person, you don't jump to violence as a first option to get your way. You don't jump to disagreement or violent my way or the highway type rhetoric, and you certainly don't jump to physical violence ever, you know? And there's a weird sort of dichotomy, I think, that being uncomfortable with it, not facing it, when it feels like time to increase, you know, accelerate your rhetoric or your energy or your, just that it becomes appropriate to escalate to a point of disagreement to stand up for yourself or somebody else. If you are unused to the fear feeling in your body, the adrenaline that you get, the the sort of shakiness, the emotion that comes with those sort of violent, energized spaces, I think you can overreact and make situations worse than they should be. And that's not good either. You know, being able to hold on to your cool or whatever, hold on to your button. So I guess I wanted to talk about that stuff today. And there's a lot of discussion in here about that. A lot of history that we learn whitewashes out any sort of active resistance. They want you to only think people just talked and marched and that was all that got things done. I'm concerned about where things are going in this world. And to wrap it around to this sort of mental health sort of thing, I just want to say to all the people out there who have, because if you have a mental health issue, you are already an outsider. You're already somebody that the powers that be, the people who really need therapy and will never get it, they'll consider you a freak. They'll consider you weird. They'll consider you degenerate. Something about you. Just having empathy and sympathy makes you somebody that's not on the side of the powers that be, you know? And the same way in pop psychology and popular culture related to mental health, we've done a good job of sort of all starting to learn that we're allowed to have boundaries. We're supposed to have boundaries. You know, the boundaries are, it's sort of like that notion of like good fences make good neighbors. But like, it's true. If you can prevent yourself from being entangled emotionally with people around you, you know where you start and they take off. That kind of thing is really important, right? To know like, when somebody's mad at you, that it's not that you're the worst person in the world necessarily. Maybe they're just mad at you. You know, these kinds of things. And so you learn emotionally to guard yourself and stand up for yourself. And I just want to introduce this notion of engaging. I mean, we've talked about it before, but again, engaging with things that make you uncomfortable. In the same way, I think anybody would agree, like, hey, you have to face your sexuality. You know, that's, you know, I think facing violence is important as well. It's part of being a mature adult and understanding that there are people out there who have no fear about using violence against you. And I think more often than not, we see it as emotional violence and spiritual violence, you know, oppressive sort of energies. And just knowing you're allowed to stand up for yourself, that's hard for me. That's hard for me to do, always has been. But I think I just want people who listen to this show, people who are sensitive people, caring people, loving people, they're also very vulnerable. And I want you to know that you are worth fighting for, and people like you are worth fighting for, and people unlike you are worth fighting for. And that thing again, none of us are free until we're all free. And none of us are free until we're all well, until we're all taken care of, until we're all like, okay, so there's a seat at the table for everyone. So we talked about that today. We talked about that the episode of notions of violence, utility of violence, familiarizing yourself with violence. And I don't think it's necessarily for everyone. Sort of I'll use that sexuality analogy again too. You know, if you are an asexual person, no one would say, oh, you should face your sexuality. You should come up with this and invent it. No. Some people are going to be naturally aviolent, probably, pacifistic. And that's good. That's like not a bad quality to have. Just want you all to be safe, and I want you to know that you're worth fighting for. And if it is fear that limits you from facing this or engaging with it, learning about it, strengthening yourself in the face of it, then I invite you to think about that and maybe work to overcome that. Learn the power in your own hands, in your heart, and don't be afraid of conflict. I'm not talking about picking fights. I'm just saying, don't be afraid of conflict. Don't be stuck in the frozen zone of like, is this person attacking me? Is this person attacking me? And obviously in a physical sense, but also emotionally. Don't feel like you have to, you know, be apologetic about everything for standing up what you believe in. You know, politeness rhetoric really just ensures the status quo stays strong and present. And the status quo in our country is fucking bad. It's fucking bad for a lot of people, you know? Anyway, I adore you guys. These are just some of my thoughts today, which I will continue to share, I guess. I don't know. I mean, this is tied into a lot of things. You know, there was more. We'll talk about it later. Yeah, we'll talk about it later. I was going to say there's more. It's just this sort of thing of engaging with our animal parts and putting them in a healthy container. Anyway, All right, thanks, guys. I'm going to let this thing roll. It was a good talk. We'll see you guys again Sunday at 10 a.m. If you want to join for the live stream, youtube.com/jsleeper. See ya.
So it is ending in LA, huh? People are just fucking doing whatever now.
They're doing whatever. I mean, like, okay, so hello, everyone. This is Good Bit Brain, as usual. I'll just say up front, I'll probably say this in an intro when I do the little podcast this week, but, you know, last week, Dr. Nick and I were talking about, oh, hey, Terry, what's up? Welcome, welcome. I'm glad you're here. Dr. Nick and I were talking about, you know, I've talked about it for a long time. I don't think you can talk about the mental health or whatever without talking about the material realities of the world and social issues and whatever. And we kept texting about it. And I was like, maybe we'll just change the name of the pod to like Social Workers Party and just get like expressively, like explicitly political all the time. So we'll probably continue that trend. I think it's, what's the word I'm looking for? I want to say like idle to like, stick your head in the sand and be worried about like to only talk about like self-care in the sense of like with no effect, with no, I don't know, the biggest thing I'm talking to you more consistently, I said this last week, the biggest thing talking to you, Dr. Nick, more consistently and having somebody who, I don't know, I feel like you described me once, like social work is like psychology applied to the real world, dealing with systems and dealing with a real positive effect, like positive, not good, you know what I mean? Like, effective, you know, techniques and methods, dealing with an actual system of public funding. And, you know, how does that happen? Like, how do you not just like the opposite of somebody you pay $160 or $200 or $300 an hour to listen to your dreams on a couch? And they're like, I think it means this about your mom, like the opposite of the idea of what psychology is. And I think talking about that and this sort of material approach to saying like, what are your values? What kind of person do you want to be? And then are you figuring out steps to make yourself more that person from a mental health standpoint? Then kind of carries out into everything. And I just think, any sort of like, I don't know. I think there's truth to limit your exposure if it's becoming too much, if it's making you ineffective. Then yeah, stop, turn the news off for a little bit, figure out, like, collect yourself. But the answer isn't, and then you're fine. Whoa, you turned it off and the problem's gone. Just keep doing that. That's not a solution. And so that's never going to be our solution here. And so in that being said, in these times, yes, we're going to be much more explicitly just talking about political stuff more often and things like that. So, I don't want to like, I just don't want anybody unprepared for that. This isn't going to be like typical. Not that if you're around, you already know that. So anyway, I don't know what I'm saying that for, because we're going to keep being My Good Bad Brain probably for the foreseeable future. I was like, I don't know, but I don't know. We're just talking about it. And this is going to be more the content often. That being said, this past week, I did have a long talk yesterday with Allie and with my brother and just about like things I was going through. And I kind of realized that, like, we were talking about the notion of, you know, this thing they say, better to be a gardener or better be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war. This idea of, like, which is interesting because I always attached it with martial arts and stuff in the past. I kind of make fun of self-defense-y type people who are, like, hardcore reality-based, quote-unquote, self-defense people, because I'm like, you're living with a terrorist every day. Like, you're, you know, this sort of... You're bringing a thing into your life that's imaginary. I think it's the way I'm feeling about it is that, I know this is long-winded, but I'm just, well, bear with me, that like the now some of that isn't imaginary. Like there is some reason that preparing yourself for like negative things out there and negative people might not be crazy. It might not be like imaginary, and it might actually be like healthy for you in the long term to do things like that. But also, I realized the way I was dealing with the anxiety and stress of how awful people are and things are and how, like, you know, ungrounded society's feeling and things that our government's doing and things like that, response for, like, reactionary responses that are so unexpected, just, you know, defending violence and stuff. Maybe a way I was dealing with the stress was by diving way too far in and too hyper focusing and like only making my life about this thing for, you know, and like steps I can take to feel like I had a handle on it. And I like had this moment where I was like, oh, I'm deep in a, I don't know if anxiety response is correct or, you know, something that on the surface was looking like, I'm fine. Fine. And then we talked about it a little bit and I start like tearing up like immediately. And I'm like, I'm very worried. I'm very afraid for everybody. And I'm scared. You know what I mean? And I'm like, oh, I really am. And so I was like, I think it's important to be honest with myself about like moderating that intensity, understanding it's a long game thing. And then also I'll say like just in some of the like preparations and like I think this idea of like boys and doomsday prepping stuff is like, especially me and my stuff that I'm into and what I like, it feels like it's going to be fun. It's like a fun, silly, fun hobby. But like, as I was like doing some supply stuff with my brother, I was just like, this is dark. I don't like that this is happening. Allie, I thought it would feel much better having my lovely, liberal, you know, smart girlfriend tell me, wow, you were right about like certain things that I was worried about in society or fascist Trump or whatever. You'd think it would feel better to be right, but it just feels dark and scary, and I don't like it. I don't like thinking about the realities of the systemic like violence that exists, and that those when that truth is being spoken to these powerful units, that they are their responses to lock down and get more reactionary and more violent and defend it, and that just doesn't bode well for where things will go. And it just all felt very, very dark and scary. Yeah. It's not fun, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know. So I thought I'd maybe we could talk a little about that same old thing about like what's the appropriate level of sort of like self-care-ish kind of stuff. But then also you specifically, I feel good talking to because you've worked with veterans a lot. And you're also like, I know your mindset around the things you do and martial arts and like Buddhism's kind of stuff. I guess I was about that notion of being a warrior in a garden kind of thing. Like this morning I was talking about that with Allie again, with my brother, this idea of it. And she said, you know, doesn't that kind of like glorify violence though in a way that's weird? And I was like, here's what I thought about it. And this is what I said was I was like, two things. One, I truly genuinely feel a lifetime of doing martial arts that gave me some both competency with violence and more like comfort around it, but also an intense awareness of the consequences of it, that you don't know what anyone can do to you and you do know what you can do to some people, and it just is not worth anything. That when you are in these moments of conflict, you're a lot less inclined to accelerate because you're not unused to the discomfort. And so like, you just never get in fights. You just know how to de-escalate because you like take it seriously. That's one. And then two, the other side of it for people who aren't inclined to like answer fight or flight with fight. That's what I'm saying is like, it both, I think being aware of violence first makes you less inclined to obey the fight instinct of flight, fight, flight, freeze. But then also if you're somebody who's more inclined to flee or freeze, or freeze rather, really flee, hopefully flee is fine, just get the fuck out of there. But if you freeze, that also, I think, especially if you're in a marginalized group of people or somebody who's like, you know, often subject to oppression by the majority cis white male class, is like teaching you that you are worth fighting for is like a valuable lesson to feel a sense of protectiveness around yourself. You know, people will have it for other people easily, but I was like, that has value. And that like, yes, like cis white straight men don't probably need to learn as a class that I'm worth fighting for, but a lot of other people do. I think women do. I think minority people some, you know, times do. It's just, do you know what I'm saying? Like that there are values. So those are the two thoughts. I was interested in talking about this idea of a warrior in a garden and not letting it get away with from you where like now you are glorifying violence or you're just becoming obsessed with this dark concept, but how like it can help prepare you. And then I have another question later, but I'll bring that up later.
I mean, I think so. These are, you know, timely and interesting topics. I would say a couple of things. I think one is we as a culture are obsessed with violence.
Yeah.
I personally am very interested in violence. I think, you know, kind of normative expression of violence, the way violence is kind of understood in society, the way that we kind of get really incoherent mixed messages about violence in our society. I think that that kind of incoherent mixed messaging is a smokescreen for what is just in reality an American obsession with violence. I mean, we just
is it? Certainly American, but is he? Do you think it's just American? Like that? That's not.
Look, I mean, look, violence is a. It's squarely in the repertoire of normal human behavior. I mean, it's mm-hmm. It's not as if violence is an aberrant phenomenon. It isn't. I mean, it's just empirically wrong to make a claim that somehow violence is aberrant. It's not, you know. I mean, we have like a social contract, and within the rules of that social contract, we normalize and excuse some types of violence and other types are not normal. And all that stuff is like secondary, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. the primary drive to protect yourself and exert your will against a resisting other by forcing them, which is violence, that's just, you know, that's mammal behavior, right. You know? So it's simply part of our repertoire behavior. And we try to control that with our social rules, govern behavior. You know, that's, put it any more simply than that. So, well, of course, like all kind of mammalian responses, there are some people who, through their own innate biology and their social learning behavior, have, you know, a real predisposition to responding with violence. And that's, you know, its own kind of complex set of circumstances. And then there are other people who are just less likely to do that because of their innate tendencies and their social learning and their environment and all this stuff. And so I think, you know, that's what we have to understand first of all, is that one, violence is one of the, within the normal repertoire of human behavior. And two, that we do have, I think, yes, America has more of a national obsession with violence than other countries. I do think that. Just culturally. Right. I mean, look at the media that we create and export.
Right.
We have a worship of violence. I mean, absolutely. We just do, you know? So, I mean, just look at our kind of national rhetoric. And I think there are probably several academic studies you could explore that would, you know, support this claim that I'm making. I think it's pretty clear. I mean, you know, what is like one of the core characteristics of American international identity that we pride ourselves on? Our superior military. I mean, if you ask like core American things are, in three or four sentences, somebody's going to talk about the military. I mean, right. It's just, you know, I think that's part of it. And then to your point about like, so given that as our kind of backdrop, to your point about whether we focus too much on it, I mean, I think it's, you know, fantasizing about violence is empowering some people. For some people, I think, fantasizing about violence to feel empowered and you feel drift and destabilized and worried, it's quite understandable, right? I mean, like, it feels like the world's going to shit. It feels like we can't trust our authority figures. It feels like there's a large group of people who just fundamentally misunderstands the reality in front of them, which is even more destabilizing. Right. And that's scary, you know? And so what can we do to kind of make that feel less scary and take a little bit of control over the situation? Well, we can sort of prepare for and fantasize about what we would have to do if it came to, like, you know, mass social violence. That some people will feel empowering. For people who have like more of a comfort level with violence, it's going to feel more empowering. You know, for people who are terrified of violence, it's going to feel scarier.
Yeah,
I think those things are those reactions are explainable and normal within this context.
I mean, you know? I guess my thought is like I don't know. I feel inside myself, I feel like this strange dichotomy of I really have fun doing violent stuff and I hate hurting people. Like, Anytime someone gets hurt, it's mortifying. Even doing jiu-jitsu against equal people who are, if you're going hard, da, 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 and some goes wrong, whether they slip or they tap a little late, you just feel miserable immediately. Like, how come I feel that way and other people don't have that?
So this is the kind of key concept is consent. You know?
Sure.
The key concept here, I think, is consent. When you are engaged in consensual violence,
right,
that is a different thing. That is an entirely different thing.
Well,
because
certainly, but I've said it. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Please continue. Sorry.
I was going to say, because it's the same with like sexual behavior, you know? You can do kind of weird, kinky shit as long as it's consensual. It's okay.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Truly consensual, not coercive. That's not real consent. I mean, right. Real consent. But when we engage in like kind of, you know, behaviors that tap into our deeper kind of mammalian, you know, violent urges, and they're consensual, I think, you know, people who in my mind I would call moral people can feel okay about that. That's why it's like I can enjoy watching like UFC. I don't enjoy seeing someone get like beat up in a street fight. I don't enjoy that, you know, because it's not really consensual. So I think that's also that concept of consent is so critical. And I think we can apply it at a larger level too. For example, this epidemic of police violence.
Yeah.
Like when you live in a civilized society, nobody should fucking put their hands on you without your consent.
Right.
Unless it's, in my view, to prevent immediate harm to someone else that can't be avoided in any other way. Because the act of putting your hands on someone and controlling their behavior without their consent, it's such a violation of their personhood and their humanity that to me, it's the most serious thing you can do.
Yes.
So to do that without consent is unconscionable to me without an overriding directive, which is to protect other people involved in our social contract, which is why it is so enraging when you see like this guy who was shot in Atlanta. There's no reason to put your hands on somebody who's fucking sleeping in his car.
Yeah.
There's no reason.
On top of that, to shoot somebody as they run away from you when you're a police officer.
For their ego, for their pride and ego. They're 100%. Ashamed to have had their taser stolen and afraid to be tased, that they would rather murder someone, kill someone, and take their life.
As they're clearly leaving. As they're clearly going away, like de-escalating.
He's going to get tased. He's going to get tased with his own taser. But you know what? If you are so shitty at retaining your taser and you're so scared to get tased with it that you'd rather kill somebody, you can't do that job. I mean, just point blank, you can't be effective in your job. So, but anyway, the point is, police officers putting their hands on people who are not engaged in violence, such a violation of our basic human dignity that I don't believe they should ever do that, ever.
Ever.
No excuse.
Yes.
Take a picture, get their fucking address, and mail them a ticket.
Yeah.
Don't put your hands on people.
Absolutely.
Are imminently going to hurt someone else. There's just no reason for that. So that's, you know, so sorry for going off, but
that's what I want to go on violence.
But consensual violence is fundamentally different from non-consensual violence.
Yo, beautiful.
It's fundamentally different.
Sorry. Okay. Terry, who's a good old friend and longtime Good Bad Brain person, but said this in the chat, and I think because I completely agree with you on this consensual violence thing, but because I want to move, because there's another aspect of it that I kind of want to talk to you about is like figuring out how to moderate. So Terry said, not glorifying violence, it's liberating fear. Within the U.S., BIPOC, I hope it's okay to say it like that. Black Indigenous people of color are BIPOC. I don't know. Tell me if I'm not supposed to say BIPOC, are forced to use violence as a tool, drugs, crime, quote, all the bad things of America to survive, 100%. Terry Bradley continues, while white systemic privilege utilizes violence as a weapon to maintain agency. And that is true. And this is kind of like also where I'm trying to talk about, because yes, I completely agree with you, obviously, about the consensual thing. That's the thing I think we've discussed in here before. But there's this notion of like, when is violence appropriate? So getting outside of the psychosexual version of it, the version of just like, it's in us, we need a healthy way to put it out there because it's never appropriate in society. But I think the message of it's never appropriate.
So I don't think it's true. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. Is like I'm at this place where violence is dark and poisonous when it's the version of it that is about actual real. I need it. We need it to, you know, liberate this fear. We need it to, you know, it feels scary to face someone who really hates you or really, or face the possibility even. They talk about in this, it's so strange to me, that book On Killing, it's like was so moving to me and such like, I would say one of the most important books I read in my life, this book On Killing. It's this guy Grossman, this Colonel something, Lieutenant Colonel in the Army, wrote this book about the psychology of killing and how fucking abhorrent it is to us instinctively to do violence against other humans, especially like lethal violence. It's really powerful. They talk about how like almost every war throughout human history, based on the records they can find and then the real numbers they ran during like World War II, that they found that there's this thing called like the soldiers like prerogative to miss, that like soldiers who attempted to shoot to kill the enemy willfully Terry just goes, history has made the color of our skin the consent to violence. Damn. That's crazy. But anyway, sorry, let me finish this thought. This is going to keep coming up. Was that like, it was like 15 to 20%, like one, like less than one in five of soldiers who are trained to go fight fucking the Nazis, even in World War II, people who are like, these are bad people, whatever. Like you, they wouldn't try to kill the enemy. They'd pretend to shoot, so they look like they're doing their job, but they just won't do it because it's so abhorrent to us to hurt people. I thought this was like a beautiful notion to realize. They talk about in the book how awful, they call it the wind of hate, that if you were close enough to see the enemy and feel like how awful it felt that someone was trying to kill you, that you just felt, why are they doing this? Like, why? It's like you could feel what they call the wind of hate. It's just an atrocious thing. It's such a failure of our common humanity, and it would just like scar people. And to me, this is a very beautiful book to realize, wow, that's really wonderful to know, like, most, the majority of people. Turns out that the guy who wrote the book is a fucking total psychopath who, like, thought it was a problem to solve. And he did it. He, like, they came up with all these methods of indoctrinating people. He teaches cops, like, these horrible warrior mindset fucking, like, the guy who shot Philando Castile took, like, these bulletproof cop things that basically teach him to shoot first and ask questions later. It's fucking terrible, like, that you have to be, and on top of it all, like, the guy who's teaching everybody to like prepare yourself to kill mentally, you can do it, and all this horrible shit. Never killed anybody in his fucking life in line of duty. Never, ever. It's like, it's always these dead eye fucking psychopaths who come. It's awful. Who tell other people to do it. But on that thing, I was thinking to myself, I was like, so we have this relationship to violence in this country where half of, broadly speaking, half of people are like liberals and stuff, who it's just like, they only are reinforced the narrative of nonviolent protests through MLK, which now I feel like is like a total fucking propaganda scheme. They don't talk about the deconstructed defense and justice, and they don't talk about how anti-capitalist he was. It's just like, they don't talk about Malcolm X in the same like positive terms they talk about MLK at all, because of this like, that any version of violence is bad and inappropriate. The same thing you see now when people see rioting or see like the burning of a police precinct, which is a totally legitimate expression of like of protest and declaration of like, you know, after this hundreds of years of systemic violence, which again, Terry, that's fucking really intense to think history, yes, has made the color of certain people's skins, they consent to violence automatically in the mind of the state. That liberals can't see that that's appropriate, that sometimes violence is appropriate as a political statement, as just like the correct motion to say like, I deserve to survive and I deserve to thrive. And on the other side of it, why there are so many people who see a cop shoot somebody in the back or shoot somebody in the head who's like fucking handcuffed and not respond, or just lean on someone's neck and go, that's appropriate. That violence to them is an answer all the fucking time if it comes from authority. So how do you find this zone where you create a healthy relationship where people who are compassionate say, no, I'm allowed, and people are allowed to use this to save their own goddamn lives and protect themselves and stand up for what is just. And the other side also starts to learn like, hey, that's a fucking awful way to think the world works, that authority is always allowed to kill you.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, I would say, actually, I don't think it's the whole point is that it's not consent. Again, consent is an agreement between two equals, right? Equals, right, in the sense that they have an equal access to power, okay? So state violence and police violence doesn't involve any consent at all. We've simply passed laws justify the use of force and violence against some people because just deem that to be okay. And you can trace the historical through line, you know? But yeah, I mean, that's the issue, is that we've actually deprived the opportunity to withdraw consent from Black people, from poor Indigenous people, from people of color, from queer people, from trans people. We've said, you don't get to be involved in the discussion of consent. You're just going to be a victim of state power. And people are so brainwashed, they think that that makes it justified.
Well, also, I mean, also, of course they're fucking brainwashed. That Unkilling book talks about, like, the way they fucking fix the problem of human compassion is, like, operant conditioning. They would just change methods of, like, how they trained them so that when you saw a silhouette, you shot. And when you think about that, and you're like, I mean, I literally said, I used to say, I was like, when I was like a teenager going to do martial arts in the city with people from all these different backgrounds, prior to that, living in like these white affluent suburbs, I was like, the most exposure I had to people of color was fucking like cops. You know what I mean? Like, you're programmed. And then, like, until you meet fucking human beings, you know?
A lot of people don't. I mean,
which they don't. No. So I'm just like,
okay, I don't think, of course, like, saying hi to somebody in the office. I mean, like, going over to somebody's house, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, I think the point is here that people say glorifying violence. I mean, I've never found a literary or like film example of glory that isn't inherently violent. So I think the idea of like
that's interesting.
Glorifying violence. So I think the concept of glory, I mean, this is like from the Iliad, you know, the concept of glory is inherently violent. I mean, it inherently refers to the kind of victory in battle or violence. So I don't think you would use the term glory to describe something that's nonviolent. So the concepts are inherently linked. Okay. And the second piece of that is that, this idea of, you know, violence being inherently glorified, particularly in our kind of Judeo-Christian Western-centric civilization and set of values and norms, that does poison people's minds. That you know, that has become a pathway to manhood, to strength. You know, and we don't have alternative pathways that are based around consent and nonviolent ways of maintaining social order. We just shouldn't be using. I mean, I think it violates our other values to use violence as a tool of maintaining social order in the sense of correcting minor deviations from the social order, selling cigarettes,
insane,
walking across the street, having a broken taillight, which we all know is just an excuse for profiling, using violence to correct those minor departures from our social order, and only for a certain group of people. People are like, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. No, it does make sense, because we have a culture that glorifies violence at the expense of the freedoms of certain groups. It's not that it doesn't make sense. Those cops are doing what they were trained to do. That is the philosophy of policing. It's not as if it's some aberrant, crazy thing. It's literally what they were trained to do. Culturally inculcated to.
I mean, fucking, think about it. I mean, Terry, like, I mean, like, you know, Terry's Indigenous and talks about that stuff, like, all the time. It's very important. It's, like, literally how we fucking programmed as children. Cops and robbers, cowboys and Indians. You know what I mean? Like, we're programmed this, like, hundreds of years of state. That's the thing that keeps coming back to me about all this stuff: systemic oppression, racism, like crime, quote unquote, which Terry was talking about earlier. Which is, again, we talked about this last week. Is like, capitalism guarantees unemployment, so you guarantee crime. Like, that's how the systems work. Realizing that these things are features, not bugs, of the way our world is set up. That it's not like the liberal idea that like no, we're gonna figure out. No, that's just it, we're working it out. It's like such bullshit. Like, these are things that are built into the system. That is how the system... Even that notion that you're just saying of glorifying violence is so interesting because, like, especially if you look back at, like, Iliad shit and stuff like that, is, like, The idea of raw power is to be respected. That, like, it's weird to read old books and texts that, like, completely, there's no, like, now a lot of like Western cinema and stuff like that has made it like action cinema has they put a veil of justice. Like, they need to give you a reason that it's okay for them to go do all this violence that you just get off on. But back in the day, not necessarily. It was just like, no, if somebody could destroy something, someone, if they could, like you said, impose their will, non-consent, that was like good. That was like they had, there was glory in that, you know, just like the power, the raw power was to be respected and admired. I don't know. So I think, like, getting back, this question that is a pickle to me is like how to create a healthy relationship that you are like, okay, that's another thing. I realized when I started doing martial arts and stuff like that, I'm very lucky that nobody in my family was ever physically abusive, like, ever. So physical violence was, I thought to myself, this was like a double-edged sword when I started to do like more like contact combat sports and stuff. I felt all of a sudden, this is a weird comparison, but, well, not really, because I always talk about like the sex and violence duality and the consent, and that they're very similar. I was thinking, like, when you're a teenager, before you've ever kissed anybody, and like, it feels so impossible to cross this physical divide. You're like, there's like a fucking force. Oh my God. And so at some point, as you grow up and become more like you've done it, and now it's like, okay, kissing somebody is in your social lexicon. Like, when it's appropriate and you're like, ah, go for it. You go for it. It doesn't feel like this no man's land that if you try to come out of the trenches, you're just getting machine gun. You know what I mean? Weird metaphor, but you know what I'm saying. Vice versa, I was like, I realized one day with after doing a lot of combat sports that an anxiety of physical contact had disappeared, where now violence felt like part of a social lexicon. And I was like, oh, the real, like, one of the real awful tragedies and realities of putting violence in people's life, of like hitting a kid or something like that, isn't just that you've done them physical violence, or assaulting somebody, isn't just that you've it's not the semi, like, the short window of the pain that you've caused them. It's that you've taught them that's a part of the social lexicon. Is when somebody can't handle their feelings or can't, you know, communicate with by another means, now they can do that. And that, like, they'll carry that forward and do it to other people as well. So I'm, like, thinking to myself, it makes sense that somebody, that you'd have a response one way or the other. That you'd either go like, oh, damn, someone victimized me, I'm going to be powerful now, and I will carry that ability to victimize in the future, and that's actually good and correct. And other people would have this abhorrent response where they say, that was horrible, I never want to do that to anybody. And, like, how do you cultivate a thing where you're like, basically, how do I get it where, like, people who hate violence also know they're allowed to do it to protect other people and themselves, and people who think violence is really fucking cool get used to the idea that it's fucking horrible and, like, feel afraid of it and afraid of hurting people. You know, how do we create this balance, this appropriate relationship in people?
I mean, I think it's really difficult. I mean, look, no.
Or sorry, last little thing, little anecdote. Or how do you fucking understand, get people to understand the consent thing even? Like, I was talking to a friend because I love jiu-jitsu, right? And I've been a big proponent that I think jiu-jitsu makes people better people. There's no way you can do it without it making you a better person. That's fucking wrong. Because a lot of the people who, like, are big voices in jiu-jitsu are completely reactionary fascists. And I had one friend who, because I've been saying a lot, and I do think it's true, it's like the banning of chokeholds and stuff. It's like fucking stupid. It's like that has nothing to do with the systemic problems. They've been banned. And frankly, if you were not a racist or terrified or like violent person, a good blood choke is a really safe way to put somebody out and just go like, okay, stop. You just don't keep fucking murdering them. But like, I would think that would be correct. My friend was like, that's not correct. What like, he does jiu-jitsu too, and was saying, you know, told me the story about like when he was new white belt and this like guy who was a cop he trained with had him in a Kimura and like didn't respect his tap as a white belt and was like, people can't tap in the street, you know? And it's like, it's like completely breaking the contract of what makes jiu-jitsu function, you know? And you're like, okay, so this guy's a fucking psycho. Like, how do you, so I'm like, clearly I'm wrong, you know, that like universally people will do this sport that humbles you and it'll make you not be such a piece of shit. Do you know what I mean? Like, so where does it come from? Why are some people so fucking cruel? And like Terry said, the system isn't broken. It's working perfectly in the way it was designed. It's true. I don't know. I know this is like an impossible question, but it's like, that's where I'm stuck with, you know?
Look, Yeah, look, I mean, I think there have been violent psychos since there have been people, you know, and you're not going to prevent, just because it seems like, you know, there is like the nature and nurture process, sure, that kind of give rise to that behavior, you know. I just don't think it's productive to, and some people should do this, and I respect and I'm interested in their research agendas, but trying to understand the precise inputs and outputs that lead to psychopathy, like, that's, I'm not that interested in that. What I am interested in is making sure those people never get into positions of authority. And the problem is that we have systems that reward behavior. We have systems that reward narcissism, manipulation. That's why there's a disproportionate number of sociopaths running Fortune 500 companies and in politics, you know, because precisely those traits, narcissism, self-promotion, shallow charm, these are things that help people to get ahead. When we're going to have, if we're going to have professions allow people to violate the social contract and put their hands on other people without their consent, we just have to have incredibly rigorous systems in place that prevent psychopaths from getting into those jobs and that, right, prevent psychopathic cultures from taking root. And the only way to do that is to have unremitting, unceasing, what is the word? Transparency and inspection of those people at all times. They just can't be entitled to privacy ever.
Yeah.
All of their interactions have to be scrutinized.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's an incredible privilege, incredible placement of trust in people, that most important thing in our social contract is that I'm free. I am free pursue my goals as long as they don't hurt anybody else. I mean, that's the basic assumption.
Right.
That means that you don't ever get to touch me unless I am going to really hurt somebody else. Right. So if we're going to have people enforce that rule, they have to be scrutinized at all times. Mm-hmm. If there's even the smallest violation of the rules around that scrutiny, they need to be immediately gone. There can be zero room for error.
Zero. I mean,
That's the reality.
I think the idea of what
we're just not there, because people don't care about violating the consent rules around minorities. We just don't care about that.
Don't. You know, that's interesting. You know, I keep thinking about this thing this week, and that just came back into my head too, is, you know, the Margaret Atwood thing that she said about, you know, that the biggest fear a woman has of a man is that he will kill her. And the biggest fear a man has of a woman is that she will laugh at him.
Right.
I feel that metaphor carries through to, like, basically white people, like the notion of the Karen, you know, the ruling class that will use the arm of violence for anything. They see a black person birding, and they don't like that they told them to put their dog on a leash, and so they will threaten their life with the, or even to me when she is making that phone call and saying what she's saying into the phone, that is the same as flashing a gun at somebody. She is like brandishing a fucking gun at somebody. And it's almost more, it is, it's worse than brandishing a gun at somebody, because not only are you implicitly, not only are you threatening someone's life and saying, I could kill you, but you're saying, like, I don't even need to, I could get one of my servants to kill you. That my servants that I have set up in fucking society to do what that's, and this idea that there's like, it makes me very upset. I'm getting very emotional. That, like, the idea that we're living in this world where we have created a structure where one type of person is, I don't know, just has ensured this iniquity and this, like, willfulness that if I can't get a fucking haircut, I'm allowed to come threaten to murder cops. And they go, good point, sir. Good point. And that, like, if we are actually murdering a kind of person, that those people, when they burn down a Target, we're like, oh, these fucking... You know, it's scary, white, and sucks to live in that world.
White people's pride and comfort is more important than the lives of black people, mm-hmm, and people of color. That's what it is.
Yeah, and I think that's what I was. How do you get people to differentiate what actual? Because you were saying this word freedom, right? Like, that's the thing I thought about a lot. Like, this epiphany that socialist thought is actually about freedom. Like this idea that it's been seized, you're like, you're guaranteeing, you're trying to create the freedom for people to express themselves however they want and have their actual lives and not be like under the thumb of like fucking bills to like decide what kind of human or dignity they're going to be, you know, like real freedom. How do you get people to like, when I think when, you know, cops have their authority threatened, they think their life is being threatened. You know, when they are threatened with discomfort or just or threatened with the idea of saying like, hey, just ignore other people living their own life, doing what they want to do. That's not violence against you. You know, having a boundary, you having a like, I don't like people that are loud or different than me. You know, like that's not violence against you. I don't think white people understand that. Like, do you know what I mean? Like as a culture, as like the capital white people, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, which is why, you know, banning chokehold is not the issue. It needs to be banning any physical contact at all for any reason other than imminent threat of death.
Yeah, that's fucking true. That's really true. That's actually that, good.
That's the only reason people should put their hands on other people ever. From a you know, legal perspective.
Yep. Do you know what I'm saying? Like that question of like, how does that happen? That some people get the idea that a little bit of inconvenience and in their life is the same as being attacked.
They've been taught that through centuries of systemic racism. They've been taught that message, and it's been reinforced for them because it's been true. I mean, it's true in our culture. That's why people think that. Because they're right, our culture.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. They're right.
To your point about like how much time to spend on this, I think it makes sense that people spend a lot of time like preparing for violence and accumulating the accoutrement of violence, you know, because it's such a like existential problem. Like,
right.
It's like the only on-off switch in life, right? I mean, you know, if you fuck up that preparation, then that's it. Other preparation, you can kind of skate by. So I think that's why it makes sense that people devote so much cognitive resource to it. The other piece is that, you know, it's more fun and a little bit easier than doing the other stuff, which actually comprises the bulk of our everyday lives and interactions. It's probably more important for us to spend time thinking about, okay, oh, I have like hard conversations with people in my life. How do I like my work promote an alternative agenda? You know, how do I, skilled rhetorically so that I can have conversations with people with other views that just don't devolve into screaming matches? Like, how do we do all that stuff that really shifts culture? How do I, you know, how do I do like the hard work of anti-racism myself? You know what I mean? How do you, like, lots of strategies that are, I think, effective, more effective than like buying pallets of ammo, you know, but not as fun. Buying pallets of ammo.
Yeah.
But that, you know, I think that's really...
That is the hard thing. That is hard. It is hard to know, like, the not screaming match one is tough. How do I just not scream at people? How do you get people to not see it? And yeah.
Well, it's hard. I mean, there's some evidence to suggest that like a conservative political ideology, people who are very embrace their identity as conservatives, that they score higher on cognitive rigidity measures. So I think it is actually just more difficult for them to integrate new information. Now, that's true about extreme liberals too. I mean, anybody with an extreme ideology is tends to be more rigid on the like cognitive rigidity measures. It was particularly true for people who identify as conservatives. You know, I mean,
yeah.
So, you know, it's challenging.
I think it's important maybe on some level too to like engage, like to examine in yourself if the notion of nonviolence is something you believe in truly, because you don't like the idea that you think it's a failure of communication and you feel like there's nothing more abhorrent than humans hurting each other, or if it's just because you're afraid of violent people. Do you know what I mean? Because I think, with at least in my experience with like liberals and stuff, I think a lot of it's more rooted in like, don't hurt, I'm sorry, you know, like
fear of victimization is not a coherent argument against violence.
I mean, fear of victimization. Fear of victimization to empower themselves. Terry said the phrase liberation from fear, and I agree with that. I wish for that for my friends who are good-hearted people and people out there who deserve justice and stuff, to deserve it, to like gird their spirit with that. But then I want fascists to fucking learn that other people feel pain and not like joy and fucking cruelty.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the issue is like, I forget who wrote this, but, you know, people always kind of caricature the argument that's traditionally been the right-wing argument for owning guns, which is like, well, the government has drones and bombs, you know? The idea isn't that...
Yes.
The right-wing argument is not that they're going to literally, you know, have a ground war with the U.S. government. It's right. that people are less likely
right.
to resort to violence as a first resort if they know you are armed and prepared to resist. That's it. That's the argument. It's a deterrence argument.
That's what I was saying now. Personally, I think it's a political statement. Is like to have like a rifle or whatever. Just that like you're not never going to shoot. You're never. It's and I honestly think that's a thing people don't want to look at, but I kind of think the psychopaths protesting for two things. One, the psychopaths protesting for haircuts with rifles all over them obviously are part of the system to be protected by, that they're being protected by it. That the cops there who are like, yes, sir, I agree, sir, are like on their side. So there's that. But I also think,
so though, funny to me.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, those people are in far more danger of dying from heart disease and diabetes than they are from Antifa. But 100%. Like,
Antifa, hilarious. The other side of it, though, is part of me thinks, like, if protests were what they are now, I don't want to even say this, but I was going to say just nonviolent, peaceful expressions of this stuff, and they just happen to have, like, Deacons for Defense and Justice. So they just had groups of people around who are also armed, as a political statement, not to have shooting matches with the cops, obviously. That would be an incredible, atrocious failure. It'd be an atrocity. I mean, it'd be horrible. Nobody wants that. But I think it's a political, and I really think if it was like, not just like a lone gunman psycho. That's the other thing is, you know, somebody was, I think it was a Boogaloo guy. So those guys fucking suck. And it's like, whatever. But one of those guys was like alone open carrying or something like that. And he got killed. Like, it can't be like one person showing up in march like that. It has to be something organized and disciplined with a group of people as an expression. And then it's a political thing that says like this, that oppression of systemically will have a cost. Like, coming in and trying to do this will have a cost. And it changes the calculations in someone's, it honestly is the same as in the microcosm of interpersonal violence. My first martial arts instructor said to me, so, like, a lot of the lessons of, like, rhetoric lessons and philosophy lessons of my first kung fu teacher, I feel like have really been true and stood through. And he was a scary guy. He had, like, really scary presence, I feel like. Yeah, I've never met somebody who had, like, such good, like, snake eyes. Like, such like, dead-eyed, like, when he turned it on, you're like, you're the scariest person I've ever seen. You know, sometimes a little bit of a bully, but, like, good lesson, you know? That one thing he said is, like, people don't like to fight people. They like to beat the shit out of people. And if they feel like they're going to get a fight out of you, they're a lot less likely to instigate that violence. And there's different ways they can get that message. Usually, I think it's not because you are puffing your chest up back. That's a sign of fear. And that's a sign of like two people accelerating each other and two fearful creatures getting themselves into a frenzy so that they can scuffle and not hurt each other for a few seconds and people can pull them back. Or if one of them does, you know, do real violence because they're scared and hurts them really bad. Versus if you are just not rising to it, but it doesn't bother you. You're like, if that's a choice you want to make, that you want to fight, okay. But, you know, if you don't seem that it's just something in your lexicon that like kind of turns off. Here's another thing I got from On Killing that was very profound and important for people to understand who abhor violence is one thing they talk about in the book is that when soldiers were more likely to shoot the enemy was almost always when they were retreating. That they had a lot easier time, humans had a lot easier time shooting people in the back. And that there's something in people where, like, we think that if we are small and pathetic and go, please, no, blah, 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 that'll make people see you as pathetic and go, oh, my God, and see themselves and go, I'm going to stop being horrible. Unfortunately, it is true that on some horrible reptile level, That same thing with dogs. When dogs are scary and like if you run away from them, they'll chase you. There's something in predatory people. I mean, this is Jarrett. I'm not the psychologist here. Nick is a psychologist. So none of this is like, but this is just the thing I've encountered and was in this book is like, if you act pathetic and weak, predators pursue it harder. It empowers them to be more cruel and they continue being cruel. And I think there's some weird, like deep survival instinct about it too. That's like a weird, like, herd kind of thing that's like, this is a weak one. We have to kill this one. This one's like pathetic. We need to kill it. It's not going to be tough or something like that. And they just, they pour it out and they're more cruel versus if you are not afraid and if you are like, no, you can fight me, but you're going to get fucking hurt. It's going to be bad for you. And it doesn't bother me if that's what you want to do is set something off that's like, not, the predator goes, they're not responding how they're supposed to. They're not cowering. They're not like trying to get out of it. So there's something deflating and confusing. And I kind of think that there's something true about that on like a political scale as well.
I mean, people want easy targets. Nobody, if you have a choice between an easy target and a hard target, no one's going to choose the hard target.
Yeah. I just want people who are like, I just want people to know that they're beautiful and perfect and they should be brave. And you deserve. I'm fucking mad, dude. I hate this fucking situation.
I think it is hard to change. It's hard, you know, it's very hard to change culture. Very, very hard. I think I actually, you know, and of course the kind of like conservative shrieking is like, oh my God, they're canceling cops and took away Elmer Fudd's gun, which I do think is a little dumb, but canceling cops, I think but that's it is. Good. It's We don't need to see any more like cop shows where the good cop crosses the line to get the bad
guy.
We just don't need that narrative anymore. We need other narratives, and we just shouldn't be paying for that kind of entertainment.
When faced with all of the choices from pop culture symbology to choose, who's going to represent? Is it Superman? Is it the person from an alien from another planet who has all the power in the world to do whatever the fuck he wants? Nothing will ever hurt him. And what he chooses to do is to protect people different from him. Do they choose the Superman symbol? Or do they pick the unhinged fucking war veteran whose whole family died, who thinks the only answer to anybody who disobeys authority is a bullet? They want the skull, baby. They want that fucking Punisher. That's who they think they are. You know? It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, that's why these kind of like gestures at reform are just not going to be effective. We need to proceed from the assumption, in my view, that you can't touch anyone unless they're going to kill somebody.
I think that's a very good rule.
And if you mess up, if you shoot them because you think their cell phone was your phone, that's it. You're done. It's a one time. Your judgment can't be trusted. If you make an error, sorry, that's it. Just like in another job that with much lower stakes consequences, like, oh, I think this can be a good stock trade. Oops, I lost $500 million. Well, you're fired, buddy. I mean, you know,
that's
it.
Well, that might not be a great example, but.
Pack your shit, you know? I mean,
but you know what I mean? Just, those people also like get to fucking destroy the American economy and just keep doing it. So,
yeah, they get hired at another department too. But that's the point. It's like, you know, if you make the wrong call, you're done. It's one and done. That's it. And every decision has to be subject to public scrutiny. And if that sounds really hard and not fun, I get it. And it's not the job for you.
It's not the job for you.
Just don't need people out there putting their hands on people because they're like dumb and drunk or like rude or like playing their music too loud or
right
whatever
the fuck you don't like.
People uncomfortable.
Learn what a boundary actually is. Respect that other people exist. I'm fucking real. Anyway, all right. Well, you know, I don't think we got any like resolutions here today or anything. Obviously, I don't know that that'll ever happen. But thanks for letting us, thanks for joining us. Terry, especially, thank you for your contributions. Those were very good, very helpful, always. I love you guys. I'm worried about things. I guess I just stay, like, I'm really into this idea of a warrior in a garden thing. Like, better to be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war. just be sure that you don't become obsessed with the warrior part and don't become too angry and keep doing your regular life. My girlfriend was like, you're doing all this.
Still needs to like plant the vegetables. Exactly. You know what I mean?
Or maybe like fold the laundry. Like while I'm like, you know, Googling, I'm like all my prepping and stuff like that. I'm like, there's a lot of other, she's like, I appreciate it. She this is what she said to me yesterday, which was actually really good. She was like, I love you. But she was like, I think we're spending 2 to 4 hours a day talking about like these things. And it's good. I'm glad we're like thinking about whatever. She's like, I feel like you are like constantly talking to me about this lifeboat you're putting together. You got to put this lifeboat together. And meanwhile, I'm like, I still have to drive the cruise ship. Like, I still have to drive the big ship right now. Thank you. It's good. It's not, but there's still the ship to drive. And I was like, yes, that is a good, you are smart and good. Thank you. Terry, that's good. Rest is resistance. You're right. You're right. We all have to, I just think this is just, I have been exposed to so many wonderful people because of the internet. The whole thing, the internet is like this cesspool. It is. It's full of horrible idiots. But I've also met so many like wonderful people from all different walks of life who feel like the system leaves them out. Whether it's because obviously you're BIPOC or something like that, but like, or just, you know, maybe you're poor or maybe you are neuroatypical or like there's just something about you. Queer stuff, obviously. Like, I've met all these people who like the system leaves them out and they're just good people. They're like wonderful people. And I just want those people to be safe. And I want to like do everything we can to move towards a future where that flourishes. And I honestly think we'll get there as a species. I think we'll fucking get there. We will. But I don't know how many more bumps it's going to go through. And I think it's just tough. I was listening to some stuff about World War II stuff. And one thing they talked about like the insidious nature of fascism is that like in conflict, in war, that civil rights often go first. You know, they like that civil rights don't survive conflict very well. And even if you watch that Los Sandinistas, this like wonderful documentary about them, they talk about like how basically they built a paradise. They had this like workers' revolution and it was amazing. And then, you know, the Contras get funded and like all this atrocities start happening. And in within the power structures, like things started to change. Women's like rights started to go away and stuff. And that like civil rights start to disappear under these horrible things. And that there's this insidious nature of like fascism on some level can be in fighting fascism. It wins automatically because you have to take on qualities of fascism to fight it back, to defeat it. Because they glorify violence and they glorify hierarchy and they glorify obeisance and they that's things they believe in. And to stop that, sometimes you need to stop it as well, you know? And so I just think maybe that's part of it, is there's in good-hearted people, there's a fear of becoming that horror, that like if you use the thing that was used to victimize you, like violence or something like that to stand up for yourself, then, and that's what they do. That is the narrative. That is what they're trying to do right now. They say like, look at these violent people burning down fucking buildings, these looters, you know, they're trying to do it. They project their insane cruelty and violence onto the world and use it as an excuse to do it more. I just think like, don't get tricked by that and know that you and other people who are good people like deserve to be well and protected. And I think we'll get to a place. It's just that thing of the, again, warrior in a garden. It's like, how can we do the things that are abhorrent to us to protect people who need those protections and to stand up for them and to be and ourselves and be prepared for that? So you're not just steamrolled by this cruel, horrible system. And how do you have those conversations with other people who start to go, who say that, who are like these looters? Whatever. My dad is a wonderful person, honestly. Like, I think he's a really good guy, very liberal, but like live a little bit. You know, he's like in that sort of mindset, but like he's friends with like all different kinds of people living on the south side of Chicago. Like those are his friends. He's not racist at all, but, race. He's not racist at all, but this isn't even about race. This is a class. This is like a socialism thing. He's getting the same news about the Chaz, right? The autonomous zone. In the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. And it's kind of like, it's crazy out there, huh? And I'm like, it's not, you know? I'm like, I don't know what the news is saying, but it's not. And it's like, people start to build these narratives where they try to say like Antifa and like, ooh, you know, I think liberals sometimes be complicit in it because you start to go like anything that's disobedient to the state, anything that's not strict pacifism is bad. And I think it needs to be recognized that that is part of the control mechanism of a violent state is to convince you that anything, it's a Catholic, you know?
It's just shifting the narrative. Like, right. America doesn't have a historical Chaz problem. It has a historical institutional racist violence
Boom,
problem.
Boom, that's fucking good. Boom, that's so good. That's a good answer.
It doesn't have a historical looting problem or a historical Antifa problem. Yes, it has a historical racist system of violence and oppression problem.
Boom.
That's the problem.
Dr. Nick, that's a good response. That's fucking so good. That's the way to, because I was trying to, like, even my brother, he's like, not into it. He's like, I just think they're fucking up. He's like, they're doing this Burning Man thing, and it's like, it's so beside the point. It's just going to be used as an excuse to, like, da, da, da. And I was, like, struggling to be like, they're not, it's an act of protest. It's a, you know, but saying, that's a good way to put it. It's like, it is an act, these are all acts of protest. There are not systemic problems of this. This is a statement that says what you think is systemically okay when you don't see precincts and targets burning down, and you don't see people occupying like government part of the and saying, hey, pay attention, that when you don't see that shit, that doesn't mean there's not fucking violence every fucking day being done to people to keep you from seeing that shit.
It's just totally irrelevant. I mean, Seattle has better outcomes than, like, other than their horrible homeless problem, which is like non-trivial and terrible, and it's Seattle tax base supports, like, you know, state of Mississippi, and their health outcomes are 10 times better. So yeah, I'm not a huge fan of Chaz. I just don't think it matters. Like, good for them, go ahead, you know, fine, but it's not the issue. And people on the right want to make it the issue, but that's not the issue.
Yeah, it's not. When people are like, see how, it's like the same thing when people say, like, oh, you're socialist? Capitalism built that iPhone. You're tweeting about it. Why don't you go to a fucking island and start over from scratch with, like, sticks and stones and do a society like that? It's like, that's not the fucking, are you out of your mind? We're saying that workers already own the means of production. Like, what are you talking about? Like, it's not that society, the notion that, do you know what I'm saying? It's disingenuous to say, like, oh, Chaz is running out of water and power. Let's see how well their little fucking autonomous state does when we cut off the water and power. It's like, you fucking idiot. Don't be so, you know what I mean? See, this is my problem. I just scream at people. That's where I'm come to.
Yeah.
You're smarter than me. And that is a really good, that is a really fucking, that is the right way to do it. That, I think that's a really wonderful, if you could calmly say, well, there's not a systemic looting problem in this country. There's a systemic killing people who are minorities problem with state violence. And furthermore, when they say, like, they kill white people too, it's like, also including the stats of, like, obviously it's so disproportionately not white people. You should also be like, doesn't that upset you? Why are you saying, like, we don't care when they fucking do it to some of the people that look like us? Why do they care? Besides getting into, it's like, just go, like, why doesn't that fucking make you mad that somebody can just do that? Violence is not a thing that the state should be allowed to do to you fucking ever.
Oh, the problem is that when you give people enough room, the narrative that they come to is because they're racist, come to the narrative that, well, they should stop committing so many crimes. That's what you hear from people. And the answer to that is that research shows clearly that white and black people commit crimes at the same rates. They use the same rates of drugs. You have the same rates 100%. Of all kinds of other crimes, the same rates. And it's just that one group of people is disproportionately policed, arrested, forced to accept plea bargains, and then imprisoned.
Yes.
That's the difference. You know, white people smoke just as much weed. They do just as much coke. They do just as much meth. They beat their wives just as much. It's all... It's human behavior. It's pretty much the same rates. It's just one group of people is mercilessly policed. So, you know, that's the answer.
Okay, that was good. Maybe that could be a theme of an upcoming episode, is just like, because that's something I see a lot and I think is true, how hard it is to have these conversations. And maybe we'll, like, talk more about some of that. Is like,
yeah, we can. I mean, the bottom line is, you know, it's good to open with the question, are you somebody who's able to change their view based on evidence?
That's
if you get something other than a yes, I don't think it's worth it.
That's a good point, because then I guess the subsequent follow up would be like, what would count as evidence to you? Like, what would make you, what are you not going to go like, fake news? I think this thing that OAN or whatever fucking is true, you know?
That's the problem.
All right. Yeah, we are living in 1984. It's like, don't believe the evidence of your eyes and ears, you know? War is peace. Okay. Well, love you guys. Love you, Dr. Nick. Thank you so much. That was really good. I'm glad we stuck around a little longer than usual. That last thing you said about we don't have a Chaz problem, we don't have a rioting problem in this country, we have a police violence problem. It's like fucking primo shit. I love that. All right. Thank you guys so much for being here. You know, you can support the pod at mygoodbadbrain.com. Get shirts and shit. You can also go to Patreon if you want to give support Jared Enterprises. Patreon.com/mygoodbadbrain. But you can also just be donating that money to a million different Black Lives Matter causes that are out there, or like the Okra Project, or just like, you know, there's a lot of things. There's a lot of things you'd be giving money to. So do that. Okay, that's it. Take care of yourself. Self-care and hydrate. Be well. Terry said here, yes, rest is resistance as well. Please take care of yourselves and just get fucking strong. Get ready. Stand up for yourself. Protect your communities. I love you. Okay, bye. All right, I'm going to stop now. Goodbye.
All right. Thanks for joining us, guys. My Good Bad Brain is a production of Mind Jam Media. That's my little media company. Thanks to Coda for making this theme song with me. And that's it. MyGoodBadBrain.com. Patreon.com/MyGoodBadBrain. You're the best. Have a good one. Self-care. Hydrate. Be well. Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.